everyone waited for him to complete it. But when it suited their purpose, the overlords could be impeccably tactful. The inspector came through the symphony concert with flying colors, which was a good deal more than could be said for many human members of the audience. The only concession to popular taste had been Stravinsky's Symphony of Psalms. The rest of the program was aggressively modernistic. Whatever one's views on its merits, the performance was superb, for the colony's boast that it possessed some of the finest musicians in the world was no idle one. There had been much wrangling among the various rival composers for the honor of being included in the program, though a few cynics wondered if it would be an honor at all. For all that anyone knew to the contrary, the overlords might be tone-deaf. It was observed, however, that after the concert, Thanthal Tereshko sought out the three composers who had been present and complimented them all on what he called their great ingenuity. This caused them to retire with pleased but vaguely baffled expressions. It was not until the third day that George Gregson had a chance of meeting the inspector. The theater had arranged a kind of mixed grill rather than a single dish, 2 one-act plays, a sketch by a world-famous impersonator, and a ballet sequence. Once again, all these items were superbly executed, and one critic's prediction, "Now at least we'll discover if the overlords can yawn," was falsified. Indeed, the inspector laughed several times, and in the correct places. And yet, no one could be sure. He might himself be putting on a superb act, following the performance by logic alone, and with his own strange emotions completely untouched, as an anthropologist might take part in some primitive rite. The fact that he uttered the appropriate sounds, and made the expected responses, really proved nothing at all. Though George had been determined to have a talk with the inspector, he failed utterly. After the performance, they exchanged a few words of introduction, then the visitor was swept away. It was completely impossible to isolate him from his entourage, and George went home in a state of extreme frustration. He was by no means certain what he wished to say, even if he had had the chance, but somehow, he felt sure, he could have turned the conversation round to Jeff. And now the opportunity had gone. His bad temper lasted 2 days. The inspector's flyer had departed, amid many protestations of mutual regard, before the sequel emerged. No one had thought of questioning Jeff, and the boy must have been thinking it over for a long time before he approached George.
"Daddy,"
he said, just prior to bedtime,
"you know the overlord who came to see us?"
"Yes," replied George grimly.
"Well, he came to our school, and I heard him talk to some of the teachers. I didn't really understand what he said, but I think I recognized his voice. That's who told me to run when the big wave came."
"You are quite sure?" Jeff hesitated for a moment.
"Not quite, but if it wasn't him, it was another overlord. I wondered if I ought to thank him, but he's gone now, hasn't he?"
"Yes," said George. "I'm afraid he has. Still, perhaps we'll have another chance. Now go to bed like a good boy and don't worry about it anymore." When Jeff was safely out of the way and Jenny had been attended to, Jean came back and sat on the rug beside George's chair, leaning against his legs. It was a habit that struck him as annoyingly sentimental, but not worth creating a fuss about. He merely made his knees as knobbly as possible.
"What do you think about it now?" asked Jean in a tired, flat voice. "Do you believe it really happened?"
"It happened," George replied.
"But perhaps we're foolish to worry. After all, most parents would be grateful, and of course, I am grateful. The explanation may be perfectly simple. We know that the overlords have got interested in the colony, so they've undoubtedly been observing it with their instruments, despite that promise they made. Suppose one was just prowling round with that viewing gadget of theirs and saw the wave coming. It would be natural enough to warn anyone who was in danger."
"But he knew Jeff's name. Don't forget that."
"No, we're being watched. There's something peculiar about us, something that attracts their attention. I felt it ever since Rupert's party. It's funny how that changed both our lives. George looked down at her with sympathy, but nothing more. It was strange how much one could alter in so short a time. He was fond of her. She had borne his children and was part of his life. But of the love which a not clearly remembered person named George Gregson had once known towards a fading dream called Jean Morrill, how much remained? His love was divided now between Jeff and Jennifer on the one hand, and Carol on the other. He did not believe that Jean knew about Carol, and he intended to tell her before anyone else did. But somehow he had never got round to it. Very well. Jeff is being watched, protected, in fact. Don't you think that should make us proud? Perhaps the overlords have planned a great future for him. I wonder what it can be. He was talking to reassure Jean, he knew. He was not greatly disturbed himself, only intrigued and baffled. And quite suddenly another thought struck him, something that should have occurred to him before. His eyes turned automatically towards the nursery. I wonder if it's only Jeff thereafter, he said. In due course, the inspector presented his report. The islanders would have given much to see it. All the statistics and records went into the insatiable memories of the great computers, which were some, but not all, of the unseen powers behind Karelin. Even before these impersonal electric minds had arrived at their conclusions, however, the inspector had given his own recommendations. Expressed in the thoughts and language of the human race, they would have run as follows. We need to take no action regarding the colony. It is an interesting experiment, but cannot in any way affect the future. Its artistic endeavors are no concern of ours, and there is no evidence that any scientific research is progressing along dangerous channels. As planned, I was able to see the school records of Subject Zero without arousing curiosity. The relevant statistics are attached, and it will be seen that there are still no signs of any unusual development. Yet, as we know, breakthrough seldom gives much prior warning. I also met the subject's father, and gathered the impression that he wished to speak with me. Fortunately, I was able to avoid this. There is no doubt that he suspects something, though of course he can never guess the truth nor affect the outcome in any way. I grow more and more sorry for these people. George Gregson would have agreed with the inspector's verdict that there was nothing unusual about Jeff. There was just that one baffling incident, as startling as a single clap of thunder on a long, calm day. And after that, nothing. Jeff had all the energy and inquisitiveness of any other 7-year-old. He was intelligent, when he bothered to be, but was in no danger of becoming a genius. Sometimes, Jean thought a little wearily, he filled to perfection the classic recipe for a small boy. A noise surrounded by dirt. Not that it was very easy to be certain about the dirt, which had to accumulate for a considerable time before it showed against Jeff's normal sunburn. By turns, he could be affectionate or morose, reserved or ebullient. He showed no preference for one parent rather than the other, and the arrival of his little sister had not produced any signs of jealousy. His medical card was spotless. He had never had a day's illness in his life. But in these times, and in such a climate, there was nothing unusual about this. Unlike some boys, Jeff did not grow quickly bored by his father's company and desert him whenever possible for associates of his own age. It was obvious that he shared George's artistic talents, and almost as soon as he was able to walk, had become a regular backstage visitor to the colony's theater. Indeed, the theater had adopted him as an unofficial mascot, and he was now highly skilled at presenting bouquets to visiting celebrities of stage and screen. Yes, Jeff was a perfectly ordinary boy. So George reassured himself as they went for walks or rides together over the island's rather restricted terrain. They would talk as sons and fathers had done since the beginning of time, except that in this age there was so much more to talk about. Though Jeff never left the island, he could see all that he wished of the surrounding world through the ubiquitous eyes of the television screen. He felt, like all the colonists, a slight disdain for the rest of mankind. They were the elite, the vanguard of progress. They would take mankind to the heights that the overlords had reached, and perhaps beyond. Not tomorrow, certainly, but one day. They never guessed that that day would be all too soon. Chapter 18. The dreams began 6 weeks later. In the darkness of the subtropical night, George Gregson swam slowly upwards towards consciousness. He did not know what had awakened him, and for a moment he lay in a puzzled stupor. Then he realized that he was alone. Jean had got up and gone silently into the nursery. She was talking quietly to Jeff, too quietly for him to hear what she was saying. George heaved himself out of bed and went to join her. The poppet had made such nocturnal excursions common enough, but then there had been no question of his remaining asleep through the uproar. This was something quite different, and he wondered what had disturbed Jean. The only light in the nursery came from the floral paint patterns on the walls. By their dim glow, George could see Jean sitting beside Jeff's bed. She turned as he came in and whispered,
"Don't disturb the poppet."
"What's the matter?"
"I knew that Jeff wanted me, and that woke me up."
The very matter-of-fact simplicity of that statement gave George a feeling of sick apprehension. "I knew that Jeff wanted me." "How did you know?" he wondered. But all he asked was, "Has he been having nightmares?"
"I'm not sure," said Jean. "He seems all right now, but he was frightened when I came in."
"I wasn't frightened, Mummy," came a small, indignant voice. "But it was such a strange place."
"What was?" asked George. "Tell me all about it."
"There were mountains," said Jeff dreamily. "They were ever so high, and there was no snow on them, like on all the mountains I've ever seen. Some of them were burning."
"You mean volcanoes?"
"Not really. They were burning all over with funny blue flames, and while I was watching, the sun came up."
"Go on. Why have you stopped?" Jeff turned puzzled eyes towards his father.
"That's the other thing I don't understand, Daddy. It came up so quickly, and it was much too big, and it wasn't the right color. It was such a pretty blue."
There was a long, heart-freezing silence. Then George said quietly, "Is that all?"
"Yes. I began to feel kind of lonely, and that's when Mummy came and woke me up."
George tousled his son's untidy hair with one hand while tightening his dressing gown around him with the other. He felt suddenly very cold and very small, but there was no hint of this in his voice when he spoke to Jeff. "It's just a silly dream. You've eaten too much for supper. Forget all about it and go back to sleep. There's a good boy."
"I will, Daddy,"
Jeff replied. He paused for a moment, then added thoughtfully,
"I think I'll try and go there again."
"A blue sun," said Karelin, not many hours later. "That must have made identification fairly easy."
"Yes," Rashaverik answered. "It is undoubtedly Alphinidon II. The Sulphur Mountains confirm the fact, and it's interesting to notice the distortion of the time scale. The planet rotates fairly slowly, so he must have observed many hours in a few minutes."
"That's all you can discover?"
"Yes, without questioning the child directly."
"We dare not do that. Events must take their natural course without our interference.
When his parents approach us, then perhaps we can question him. They may never come to us, and when they do, it may be too late."
"That, I'm afraid, cannot be helped."
"We should never forget this fact, that in these matters our curiosity is of no importance. It is no more important even than the happiness of mankind."
His hand reached out to break the connection.
"Continue the surveillance, of course, and report all results to me. But do not interfere in any way."
Yet when he was awake, Jeff still seemed just the same. That, at least, thought George, was something for which they could be thankful. But the dread was growing in his heart. To Jeff, it was only a game. It had not yet begun to frighten him. A dream was merely a dream, no matter how strange it might be. He was no longer lonely in the worlds that sleep opened up to him. Only on that first night had his mind called out to Jean across whatever unknown gulfs had sundered them. Now he went alone and fearless into the universe that was opening up before him. In the mornings they would question him, and he would tell what he could remember. Sometimes his words stumbled and failed as he tried to describe scenes which were clearly not only beyond all his experience, but beyond the imagination of man. They would prompt him with new words, show him pictures and colors to refresh his memory, then build up what pattern they could from his replies. Often they could make nothing of the result, though it seemed that in Jeff's own mind his dream worlds were perfectly plain and sharp. He was simply unable to communicate them to his parents. Yet some were clear enough. Space. No planet, no surrounding landscape, no world underfoot. Only the stars in the velvet night, and hanging against them a great red sun that was beating like a heart. Huge and tenuous at one moment, it would slowly shrink, brightening at the same time as if new fuel was being fed to its internal fires. It would climb the spectrum and hover at the edge of yellow, and then the cycle would reverse itself. The star would expand and cool, becoming once more a ragged, flame-red cloud.
"Typical pulsating variable," said Rashavarik eagerly. "Seen, too, under tremendous time acceleration. I can't identify it precisely, but the nearest star that fits the description is Ramsandran 9. Or it may be Fanranodon 12. "Whichever it is," replied Karelin. "He's getting further away from home." "Much further," said Rashavarik.
It might have been Earth. A white sun hung in a blue sky flecked with clouds, which were racing before a storm. A hill sloped gently down to an ocean torn into spray by the ravening wind. Yet nothing moved. The scene was frozen as if glimpsed in a flash of lightning. And far, far away on the horizon was something that was not of Earth. A line of misty columns, tapering slightly as they soared out of the sea and lost themselves among the clouds. They were spaced with perfect precision along the rim of the planet, too huge to be artificial, yet too regular to be natural.
"Sidinius IV and the Pillars of the Dawn," said Rashavarik, and there was awe in his voice. "He has reached the center of the universe."
"And he has barely begun his journey," answered Karelin.
The planet was absolutely flat. Its enormous gravity had long ago crushed into one uniform level the mountains of its fiery youth, mountains whose mightiest peaks had never exceeded a few meters in height. Yet there was life here, for the surface was covered with a myriad geometrical patterns that crawled and moved and changed their color. It was a world of two dimensions, inhabited by beings who could be no more than a fraction of a centimeter in thickness. And in its sky was such a sun as no opium eater could have imagined in his wildest dreams. Too hot to be white, it was a searing ghost at the frontiers of the ultraviolet, burning its planets with radiations which would be instantly lethal to all earthly forms of life. For millions of kilometers around extended great veils of gas and dust, fluorescing in countless colors as the blasts of ultraviolet tore through them. It was a star against which Earth's pale sun would have been as feeble as a glowworm at noon.
"Hexenarax 2, and nowhere else in the known universe," said Rashavarik. "Only a handful of our ships have ever reached it, and they have never risked any landings, for who would have thought that life could exist on such planets?"
"It seems," said Karelin, "that you scientists have not been as thorough as you had believed. If those patterns are intelligent, the problem of communication will be interesting. I wonder if they have any knowledge of the third dimension."
It was a world that could never know the meaning of night and day, of years or seasons. Six colored suns shared its sky, so that there came only a change of light, never darkness. Through the clash and tug of conflicting gravitational fields, the planet traveled along the loops and curves of its inconceivably complex orbit, never retracing the same path. Every moment was unique. the configuration which the six suns now held in the heavens would not repeat itself this side of eternity. And even here there was life. Though the planet might be scorched by the central fires in one age and frozen in the outer reaches in another, it was yet the home of intelligence. The great, many-faceted crystals stood grouped in intricate geometrical patterns, motionless in the eras of cold, growing slowly along the veins of mineral when the world was warm again. No matter if it took 1,000 years for them to complete a thought, the universe was still young, and time stretched endlessly before them.
"I have searched all our records," said Rashavarik. "We have no knowledge of such a world, or such a combination of suns. If it existed inside our universe, the astronomers would have detected it, even if it lay beyond the range of our ships."
"Then he has left the galaxy."
"Yes. Surely it cannot be much longer now."
"Who knows?
He is only dreaming. When he awakes, he is still the same.
It is merely the first phase. We will know soon enough when the change begins."
"We have met before, Mr. Gregson," said the Overlord gravely. "My name is Rashavarik. No doubt you remember."
"Yes," said George. "That party of Rupert Boyce's, I am not likely to forget, and I thought we should meet again."
"Tell me, why have you asked for this interview?"
"I think you already know."
"Perhaps. But it will help us both if you tell me in your own words. It may surprise you a good deal, but I also am trying to understand, and in some ways my ignorance is as great as yours."
George stared at the Overlord in astonishment. This was a thought that had never occurred to him. He had subconsciously assumed that the Overlords possessed all knowledge and all power, that they understood, and were probably responsible for, the things that had been happening to Jeff. "I gather," George continued, "that you have seen the reports I gave to the island psychologist, so you know about the dreams."
"Yes, we know about them."
"I never believed that they were simply the imaginings of a child. They were so incredible that, I know this sounds ridiculous, they had to be based on some reality." He looked anxiously at Rashavarik, not knowing whether to hope for confirmation or denial. The Overlord said nothing, but merely regarded him with his great, calm eyes. They were sitting almost face to face, for the room, which had obviously been designed for such interviews, was on 2 levels, the Overlord's massive chair being a good meter lower than George's. It was a friendly gesture, reassuring to the men who asked for these meetings and who were seldom in an easy frame of mind.
"We were worried, but not really alarmed at first. Jeff seemed perfectly normal when he woke up, and his dreams didn't appear to bother him. And then one night..."
He hesitated and glanced defensively at the Overlord. "I've never believed in the supernatural. I'm no scientist, but I think there's a rational explanation for everything."
"There is," said Rashavarik. "I know what you saw. I was watching."
"I always suspected it. But Karelin had promised that you'd never spy on us with your instruments. Why have you broken that promise?"
"I have not broken it. The supervisor said that the human race would no longer be under surveillance. That is a promise we have kept. I was watching your children, not you."
It was several seconds before George understood the implications of Rashavarik's words. Then the color drained slowly from his face.
"You mean..."
He gasped. His voice trailed away, and he had to begin again.
"Then, what in God's name are my children?"
"That," said Rashavarik solemnly, "is what we are trying to discover."
Jennifer Ann Gregson, lately known as the Poppet, lay on her back with her eyes tightly closed. She had not opened them for a long time. She would never open them again, for sight was now as superfluous to her as to the many-sensed creatures of the lightless ocean depths. She was aware of the world that surrounded her. Indeed, she was aware of much more than that. One reflex remained from her brief babyhood, by some unaccountable trick of development. The rattle, which had once delighted her, sounded incessantly now, beating a complex, ever-changing rhythm in her cot. It was that strange syncopation which had roused Jean from her sleep and sent her flying into the nursery. But it was not the sound alone that had started her screaming for George. It was the sight of that commonplace, brightly colored rattle beating steadily in airy isolation, half a meter away from any support, while Jennifer Ann, her chubby fingers clasped tightly together, lay with a smile of calm contentment on her face. She had started later, but she was progressing swiftly. Soon she would pass her brother, for she had so much less to unlearn.
"You were wise," said Rashavarik, "not to touch her toy. I do not believe you could have moved it, but if you had succeeded, she might have been annoyed, and then I do not know what would have happened."
"Do you mean," said George dully, "that you can do nothing?"
"I will not deceive you. We can study and observe as we are doing already, but we cannot interfere because we cannot understand."
"Then what are we to do? And why has this thing happened to us?"
"It had to happen to someone. There is nothing exceptional about you, any more than there is about the first neutron that starts the chain reaction in an atomic bomb. It simply happens to be the first. Any other neutron would have served, just as Jeffrey might have been any boy in the world. We call it total breakthrough. There is no need for any secrecy now, and I am very glad. We have been waiting for this to happen, ever since we came to Earth. There was no way to tell when and where it would start, until, by pure chance, we met at Rupert Boyce's party. Then I knew that, almost certainly, your wife's children would be the first."
"But we weren't married then. We hadn't even—"
"Yes, I know. But Miss Morrill's mind was the channel that, if only for a moment, let through knowledge which no one alive at that time could possess. It could only come from another mind, intimately linked to hers. The fact that it was a mind not yet born was of no consequence, for time is very much stranger than you think."
"I begin to understand. Jeff knows these things. He can see other worlds and can tell where you come from. And somehow, Jean caught his thoughts even before he was born."
"There is far more to it than that, but I do not imagine you will ever get much closer to the truth. All through history, there have been people with inexplicable powers which seemed to transcend space and time. They never understood them. Almost without exception, their attempted explanations were rubbish. I should know. I have read enough of them. But there is one analogy which is, well, suggestive and helpful. It occurs over and over again in your literature. Imagine that every man's mind is an island, surrounded by ocean. Each seems isolated, yet in reality all are linked by the bedrock from which they spring. If the ocean were to vanish, that would be the end of the islands. They would all be part of one continent, but their individuality would have gone. Telepathy, as you have called it, is something like this. In suitable circumstances, minds can merge and share each other's contents and carry back memories of the experience when they are isolated once more. In its highest form, this power is not subject to the usual limitations of time and space. That is why Jean could tap the knowledge of her unborn son."
There was a long silence while George wrestled with these astounding thoughts. The pattern was beginning to take shape. It was an unbelievable pattern, but it had its own inherent logic. And it explained, if the word could be used for anything so incomprehensible, all that had happened since that evening at Rupert Boyce's home. It also accounted, he realized now, for Jean's own curiosity about the supernormal. "What has started this thing?" asked George. "And where is it going to lead?"
"That is something we cannot answer. But there are many races in the universe, and some of them discovered these powers long before your species, or mine, appeared on the scene. They have been waiting for you to join them, and now the time has come.